This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
I am originally from Christchurch. I was born here in 1954 and moved to San Francisco in the 80s and then back to Auckland, where I lived for 15 years, and then in Thames in the Coromandel for another few years, and then back to Christchurch in the early 2000s. And I came back to look after my mother and sister who were ill at that point in time and stayed. So I've returned to my roots. So that's a little bit about who I am. The peer support group for HIV positive people, when I returned, there was nothing, no support group for positive people in Christchurch.
What year was that?
It would have been probably, it was 2001. There had been groups, but they had, there were controversies around them all, I wasn't involved in them, so I've only had hearsay and so I'd best not talk about those. But there were, as I said, a number of initiatives, both by positive people and people who sought to support them. Some were okay, some weren't. Most weren't. The foundation, the New Zealand AIDS Foundation, I'd made contact with the clinic here, and the person, the counsellor at the time, the facilitator or the manager of the clinic, Ian Smith at the time, invited me to set up a peer support group for positive people here in Christchurch, given that I'd had a history of doing that in other places. So, and I said yes to that. So, at the beginning, Bruce Kilminster from Body Positive Auckland came down to Christchurch. And I don't remember exactly the beginnings of that, but he came down and there was a luncheon that was held at a hotel that Body Positive Auckland paid for, and it was to get positive people together and talk about whether they wanted to have, to get together and what they wanted, basically. What came out of that meeting was that there was a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, a lot of seriously psychotic people who'd been involved in other initiatives, psychotic I don't know really. They were just crazy. But overall, there was a lot of anger toward the foundation, the services here in Christchurch and the history involved. So the meeting really was a pain in the ass, actually. And so there was a youngish man there in his 30s from Ashburton, and he had never been involved in any of the support groups. And he had been involved in setting up incorporated societies and trusts in other places for other reasons. And so he offered his services to set it up. His name was Aaron McDonald. He has since died about 3 years ago. And he took on the setup of the Incorporated Society of Body Positive Canterbury. So, and that, the document that he put together was dated December 2002. So that would have been the start of Body Positive Canterbury.
Can you describe for me what the benefits are of a peer support group as opposed to something like the AIDS Foundation?
Well, the AIDS Foundation, it doesn't actually offer support to positive people. It offers counselling and testing, and that's about it, and advocacy. But there's something about just being with other positive people where you don't have to explain yourself, you don't have to interact with a counsellor, you don't have to interact with someone who could be pushing their own agenda, like a carer or whatever, or someone that do-gooder, for want of a better word. I know that's a judgment, but that's often what it feels like. And even those people who do their best to separate their own agenda from the service that they're providing, really, you know, it doesn't actually feel the same as just having other positive people. So, and one can learn quite a lot from other positive people because they're going through a similar thing and along a similar path. So, for instance, side effects of medication or how to deal with them, or what they might be if they're looking at going on to a different medication or newly going on to medication. Services in the community that may be there that the foundation staff know of but may not even think about, you know, and when you're meeting with them. So, but it's mainly just actually being around other people where you don't have to explain who you are. You don't have to say why you're not working or why you're not doing this or why you're tired or why you're not able to eat certain things or why you're not able to or why you look like you do. There's no, you know, it's a very unpressured situation. And for a lot of people, that's the only time that they actually ever have that. Is on that, you know, when they meet with their peers. So that's the benefit. And it's a huge one, I can tell you that.
So prior to Body Positive Canterbury being formed, were there kind of informal groups that were meeting? Or groupings?
There were groupings. There was a man, Colin Doherty, who's still in Christchurch, not positive, who is a masseur, and he used to have informal Sunday, once a month, I think, or once every couple of months, a Sunday barbecue or something at his house and for positive people. And that was one of the more beneficial ones. That had already stopped before I came down. But people that I spoke to only had good things to say about that. There were others that were started, and well, I don't know. It's best not to go there. Mm. But needless to say, there were occasional attempts, but I wasn't aware of any groups as such.
How was it for you coming back to Christchurch and having been in peer support groups in other places and then not having that in Christchurch? How did it make you feel?
Oh, for me, it was fine. I mean, I didn't need it. And at that point, I didn't need it. And it wasn't a need that I had for myself. So... Yes, so it was purely I was asked to do it, and I did it for the others, really. So, yeah. In fact, it's actually hard work. So, So all the way it's set up now is hard work.
Was anything put in place when the Incorporated Society was formed that would stop it kind of drifting back into some of the kind of previous times where groups didn't quite work?
No, nothing was set up in, as such, but it was, I think we had more structure probably than the others. But it came down to us having to police ourselves. And as you'll see when we get on to POS Plus and the demise of POS Plus, that really didn't work. So, yeah. So it did break down. Yes.
What was your role with Body Positive Canterbury?
Well, I was the chair of Body Positive and was the chair right through, and basically because no one else wanted to do those tasks. And so Aaron was the treasurer, and we had different people in the role of secretary.
And how many members?
It started off with about 10 to 15, and went up to about 20-25. And some of those have died and some have moved away, but the current group is still 25.
What kind of activities did you undertake?
It was mainly based around a monthly gathering. On it's always been the third Sunday of the month, and it would be a lunch, and there'd be discussion, and occasionally there'd be someone brought in, like one of the doctors or someone from the foundation or a visitor like Bruce would come down from Auckland, or someone from Australia who may be passing through, and they would talk about different things. So that was the main thing. Then we had a weekend for people in Southland, in the south of the South Island, and that had about, I think it was 15 to 20 people, all men, and that was, I can't remember the place that where we had it, but that was for most of the men there. It was the first time they'd ever met anyone other who was positive, and some of them had been positive for 15 years. So it showed us how isolated people are in the South Island, well, and in the middle of the North Island as well. And there are no services. So that was a one-off event. We were never able to get funding to do any others, even though we tried. And it was quite difficult to actually get the thing together. Because of privacy issues and all this, and how to make the contact. Fortunately, the infectious diseases specialist in Dunedin Hospital passed on a notice to all of his male clients, and that was how we were able to make contact with them. And there were one or two on our books, but, you know.
That must have been quite an amazing experience, meeting people that had not met other HIV-positive people for years.
Yeah. Well, it's something that I've had experience of ever since I've been in the field in 84. But, I mean, it's a reality in New Zealand. People outside of the main centres don't have contact, or very rarely have contact, and don't know what's provided, because they don't have any way of finding that information. And if they're not on computers or, you know, don't know about Body Positive, or, you know, then they just won't know what's available for them. And the specialists don't, they're there to look after their health, not after other things, yeah.
So what kind of conversations were had on that weekend?
A lot of it was to do with writing misinformation, we found, to begin with. So people had very strange ideas about the disease that they had. And I can't give you examples, but there were some very weird... I remember there were some very weird conversations that had... So we actually basically had to do an AIDS 101 with these people, and so that everyone was talking from the same song sheet to begin with. And then we got people to tell their story, really. And so that's how we found out just what had happened to these people, you know, and the remarkable ability that they had to survive. Yeah, that survived very well, yeah. And the telling of the stories were really great because everyone had a chance to tell their story. And some went on for a couple of hours, you know, and they were quite difficult for a lot of people to hear. And so that, you know, that... that caused some problems for some people because they'd, especially the longer term people, because they didn't want to have to bring up all that stuff, you know, that all that stuff was so far in the past, and they'd developed initiatives to not suppress necessarily, but to live with this stuff. And it had served them well, and here it was all being sort of brought up. So it was necessary to sort of take some people aside and just sit with them and really just say, well, you know, if it's too difficult, just go for a walk, and, you know, you don't need to actually sit through these things. And but for others it was really important, so... But they all did. They all, you know, it was just actually a matter of voicing it, and then they would come back. And, because I think they realised that hearing, the listening was actually just as important as the saying. And so they realised that it was important for these people to be heard. Their stories were important, you know, and... yeah, so yes, so that's it was a great weekend, and we tried several avenues of getting extra funding for extra weekends. The one story out of it that was really amazing was this: the people doing the catering was a family, a local family. And they killed the lamb for the roast dinner and all this sort of thing. They were farmers. And a mother and daughter and husband and son, I think. No, the mother, daughter and husband were all involved in this. And we couldn't work out why they were so involved and wanted to communicate with people and wanted to, you know, they weren't pushy or anything, we were a bit concerned that they may have had some sort of religious agenda or whatever, but that never eventuated. And right at the end of the weekend, they were thanked at the end of the weekend by the full group. And the husband then said that he wanted to tell us a story, and that the story was that their son had just come out as a gay man, like literally, I think, that year. And they wanted to do this so that they could actually learn more, meet more gay men, and learn what it was to be, you know, something about being gay. And to be informed about HIV so that they could support their son not to become infected. And I thought, it was really quite amazing. I mean, you know, they were crying when they were saying this, and it was like, yeah, pretty full-on stuff. So yeah, so it was quite an amazing weekend, right in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was somewhere Milton or something like that, way the hell out in the middle of nowhere and out of Dunedin. So it was like, oh, okay.
You say that it was hard to get funding. Why do you think that was?
Well, the foundation gave us some funding towards it, but I mean, it actually cost quite a lot of money, and to support people to get there, number one, you know, it's not easy. And we wanted to do another one in the north of the South Island, and that would have even been bigger. But to get the people there was going to be a difficult one. And I think the budget was something like $15,000 in total. I mean, it was a weekend. We brought in a facilitator from Auckland. So we all had to get down there, and he had to get down there. And we had to hire the venue, pay for the food, and it needs to be comfortable and it needs to be good. You know, it's no good just having a camp. I mean, it has to be, some of the people are not well, and, you know, and they need, and they're on benefits and things like that, and why should they, you know, have fish and chips? You know, it just didn't make sense. So we made sure that the food was good and the place was warm and, you know, and clean and all that sort of thing. And I mean, bedding had to be supplied, all that sort of stuff. I mean, it was quite an event, and it's amazing how quickly and then there's postage and contacts and phone calls, and it's quite a nightmare, really. And getting people from A to B was the most difficult.
I guess I was wondering, is peer-to-peer support seen as a valid thing in terms of funders when they're looking to fund something? Did you find that generally?
In funders, yes, it was good. We always had funding support from various trusts around the place. I mean, the work involved in getting those was phenomenal, and that was what created the problems at the end of POSBUS. The foundation supported us with various amounts, but not a lot, because they had their own things, and we were our own organisation at that point, and we were getting funding, so we never wanted to really tap into their stuff. I mean, they supported us, but and supported us generously, but you know, it was we preferred to try and get our own stuff. One of the problems was that Body Positive Auckland saw themselves as a national organisation and applied to all the South Island trusts. So when we would apply, because our name was similar, they would say that we'd already been funded, and when we were two different organisations. And that led to problems between our organisation and Body Positive Auckland, and also led us to change the name to POSBUS. So, but that's still, it was still difficult, and Body Positive Auckland never took us off their website as a branch, for about another 2 years after we changed the name, which was about when we stopped. So, it's like Christ. Anyway.
So when did the name change to POSBUS?
I think you said 2006, which would be about right. Yeah. It was about 2 years before the end. I think we finished in 2008.
You mentioned earlier on that the chairperson's job was a really hard one, that nobody really wanted to kind of take that on.
No one wanted to take it on. It wasn't hard. It was just that no one wanted to take it on. I was the coordinator of the group. So chair is just the title that I had. But facilitating or coordinating the group, no one else. They wanted to come along. They didn't want to actually do any of the work. So in organising it or facilitating it. So We only ever had three people, really, who were involved in organisational sort of aspects of it.
So how much time a week, say, would you be spending on organising events?
I'd say it'd be a couple of days a month. And that included phone calls with Aaron, which would go on for hours. And you had to know Aaron and the other person involved. And then it was coordinating the food and the... At times we were meeting away from... At the beginning, we met away from everyone's house. And so at the beginning, it was actually at the foundation. So that meant going and picking up a key, then going back again on the day, unlocking it, setting it up, cleaning up, then taking the key back on the Monday, all this sort of nonsense. And then we moved to another place, and that involved exactly the same stuff. And then finally I just said, I've had enough. So now the group meets at my house. And it has done since then. So, and it's so much easier. But it's getting the food together, you have to come up with a menu, you have to buy the food, you have to, or bring it in, you have to go and pick it up, you have to go shopping, you've got to clean, a group of gay men coming to your house and other people, but the gay men in particular, I mean, you know what it's like. So you've got to clean, you've got, you know, and also it does need to be cleaned because of people's immunity and lowered immunity and stuff. And it's only once a month, but it's still a whole weekend goes. And then you've got to set it all up. You've got to cook them at food if it's been cooked. And then you've got to host it. And then you've got to clean up. And so it's a whole weekend. So it's a whole weekend plus. So, but it works. It's a lot easier doing it that way than having to go to somewhere, because it's much more pressured.
So POS Plus didn't last that much longer, did it? Was it a couple of years before it?
Yeah, one of the problems was, well, the problem was that Aaron got ill, and seriously ill, which ended up in him dying. And at the same time, we talked with the membership, and they were supportive of continuing on, but not setting up another organisation. And so the foundation said that they would support us for the funds for the lunch, and. And so we never set up another organisation, and we just use an umbrella organisation to receive the funds, and we just have the lunch, and that's it. And we're not affiliated with any groups. We're not an official organisation, or a legal entity. We don't have any contact with Body Positive Auckland or Positive Women in Auckland or the Wellington Group. The foundation, well, we have monthly contact with them because they give us the money, but that's about it. And it works. It's much easier and it takes all the pressure out of it. And yeah. So, and it just means that we provide peer support, full stop, nothing else. So we don't get into the politics, which is pretty nasty. Between organisations, or can be, and so it sort of frees us up just to look after each other, really. Mm. So that's the history. Yes.
So the Christchurch support group came out of POS Plus, and what kind of activities did that do?
It solely provides a once a month gathering. Yeah. So there's no advocacy or politics or any of that type of thing involved. occasionally we may discuss an issue that that someone wants to talk about. But again, we don't have contact with any of the other groups. So, you know, they don't contact us, we don't contact them.
Yeah. How many members?
There'll be about 25 on the books. We don't get that many. We don't get that many to any one gathering. But we, at Christmas time, we always get close to 20. But we've never had the full 25. Yeah. But there are 25 that get notified. Mainly men, but for men and women. Yeah.
So there we are in 2008, 2009, and suddenly at the end of 2010, there is a major earthquake in Christchurch.
Mm-hmm.
What impact did that first earthquake have, well, on you and also the group?
The first earthquake didn't have much of an impact on the group at all. So, well, not a, well, some individual members had problems with their house, but they were repairable, and but none of them actually had any major thing occur that I remember after the first one. For me, it was sort of like the first one was a non-event, really, compared to the others. But the first one, I mean, it was interesting and it was, you know, it was scary and all the rest of it. But there was no damage to the house I was in at that point in time. And we just carried on, really, yeah. So there were no issues after the first one.
Had you ever experienced something like a magnitude 7.1 earthquake?
No, not really. No, not like that. No. I'd been in the Anangahua earthquake here in Christchurch, and that, but that was nothing like that at all. But the second one was far worse. The first one was nothing really. I mean, I was in bed. It was at 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was. And it was just like someone was rocking the bed, really. But and the aftermath of it was more bizarre because it was dark, so there was no power in the area, and alarms, car alarms were going, and people were outside sort of talking on the streets and things like that, and you'd see sort of candles moving in the windows of houses and stuff like that, and then there'd be the occasional aftershock and thing. But yeah, after a while, I mean, it was just back to sleep, really. Yeah,
that kind of immediate reaction of just walking into the street, having it kind of pitch black with no power, that must be quite a surreal.
Well, it is when you're in the middle of the city and you're used to it, and very quiet, except for the alarms and things like that. You know, it's like you don't have, like, there were lots of takeaway bars and things all around it where I used to live, and their refrigeration units would be going all the time. So there was this constant hum, but they'd all gone off. So it was just, it was quite strange silence, really. And because it was in the middle of, you know, early morning, the traffic wasn't around and that. So it was just fortunate that it was then.
Where were you living?
I was living in Spraydon at that point in time, so in Angus Street. So it's very central to the city. So it's basically, actually it's in Sydenham, one block away from Brougham Street. So,
did you think at the time that there would have been casualties from that kind of sized earthquake?
I wondered. But, I didn't know, really, yeah. Because there was no damage around us. So all our chimneys were all well up. And it wasn't until the next day when I went out to shop or something and I noticed that all the chimneys were down all the way along the road. further down, and you know, and all this sort of thing. And I was thinking, well, there's a bit more to this than what meets the eye. Mm. But yeah, there wasn't. It didn't have much effect at all. So in between that earthquake and the bigger one, which I call the bigger one, I moved into an old villa on the other side of town. And that villa had no chimneys left, so they'd fallen down. The bricks were still on the roof when we arrived, and they hadn't been cleared off. And they just had tarpaulins over the holes. And that was the only major damage that had been done to it.
Had you moved because of earthquake damage in the first place?
No, I moved because the other place was too small, and a friend of mine had come back from France and wanted to stay and flat together, and so we moved into a bigger place. And it's such a beautiful area where we moved to, so compared to the other one.
And where did you move to?
St. Albans, yeah.
So going forward, I think 6 months to February, where right. You say that the big earthquake, which was actually lesser in magnitude but closer to the surface, wasn't it? Yeah. Mm. What was that?
That was far worse, because it had a bigger impact, and it was, it was in the afternoon, so I was at home on that day and was sitting at the computer and remember when it started, looking down the corridor, and the back of the house was moving, swaying left, you know, back and forth. And the beginning wasn't too bad. I mean, things were falling and that. And then I thought, hang on. And then I stood up, and that was when there were two jolts, very heavy jolts, and they threw me to the floor. So, and that was when everything fell over that was going to fall. It was quite a strange experience. That one was far worse in experience than the other. And there was no surety at all. I mean, you know, if you'd been outside, you would have ended up on the ground. And the whole of the inside was trashed, really. So, you know, bookshelves. I mean, it was our fault that we hadn't actually attached them to the wall. But, you know, they were all on the floor, books everywhere, and things smashed. And, you know, all the support group, because we had like dinner sets and things like that for lunches and that. And that was all gone. Cupboards had come open and things had just fallen out. That was the main damage. I mean, there was damage to around the where the walls meet the ceiling. They were all cracked, and plaster was falling off and things like that. Windows broke, or cracked, I should say. Fireplaces moved, like cast iron fireplaces started walking out into the room. Other than that, then we had no power and no sewage and no water. So this one was far worse. And so to get water, I had enough in the tank that would slowly come out of the tap. So there was a little bit in there that I could access, and then that dried up. So a news came through that you could actually get water just around the corner, because there were cordons around the inner city, and at each of the streets they had water bottles, big stacks of water bottles that you could just go and help yourself. So I went around and got some of those. And
that must have taken a while to actually put in place, though.
No, it was very quick. Yeah. It was the next day. Yeah, it was all, it was there. In fact, it was early morning that I went around and got all that. So they'd been very fast in getting that service there. There was certainly no sewerage, so you couldn't use the toilets. Well, there's no water, so you couldn't flush a toilet. So you had to rig up toilets outside and things like that. Because there were no portaloos and chemical toilets and all that. They didn't arrive until, well, weeks after. And the water wasn't put on for a couple of days, I think. But we were fortunate where we were in that the water and sewerage came on quite quickly. And although you had to boil the water for drinking and sewerage, what started happening about a week afterwards was that you'd have these enormous trucks that would appear in the street, at the end of the street, and they'd be doing this sort of, I don't know what they did, but it was either they were sucking the stuff out or they were pushing it along or something. But what they were huge things, and the noise was phenomenal, and they did it every week almost around us. And then they'd come to the manhole outside the house, and then you had to go in with a brick and put it on the lid of the toilet. If you didn't, as happened with us, you'd end up with shit and paper and God knows what all over the room, because they'd blow something through it and to clear the pipes, and it was like far out, and you know, it's just like everything everywhere. It was like, oh, what a nightmare. So, and there's no warning that they'd be there, you know. It's like, so we got used to that. But
just taking you back to the time when the earthquake actually happened, how long did it go for?
It seems like forever, but it wasn't. I think it was less than a minute. I think it was, yeah, less than a minute. But it felt like it was quite long, but it was the lead up that was sort of like a rolling thing, and then these two jolts, and of course it's not just the main earthquake, it's all it goes on. The earthquake might only last for, the actual earthquake might only last for a matter of seconds, but there seems to be, it's like when you get off a plane and you're sort of after a long trip and you feel like you're still moving. It has that sort of sensation, and I think it is actually the ground still moving. But it's quite strange. And then, of course, you have all the aftershocks, and they start happening within minutes, and they can be as intense, or not quite as intense, but intense enough.
Was there any sound?
Oh, yes. Yeah, sort of a rumbling, like with the jolts, it's like a quite a powerful smack sound, or crack or whatever. Yeah, it was quite an interesting earthquake, really. Yeah.
When that happens, I mean, I just kind of try and think what would be the first thing that I would do. You know, how would you prioritize? What did you do first?
It was interesting because I'd got up because I thought I'd better go to the door, you know, because I've got an outside door in my room. And I was heading towards that when I was thrown over. And because everything had fallen around us in the house, it was like, and all of that happened in the middle of, you know, I mean, I was on the floor and I thought, far out, the house is going to fall down. And because that's what it felt like. It did actually feel like the whole place was like, you know, going to just take on a lean and go, you know. Plenty of places did around us. But so the first thing was that I'd heard all these things falling. So I got up, and it's sort of like walking around in a daze, really, because you've got adrenaline, and it's like you're walking around sort of like, not knowing exactly really what you're doing. And so all I did was wander around and just survey what was going on or what had gone on, and then walk around the property, because there was no point in doing anything inside at that point. walk around the property and just check and see that everything was all right, and then check on the people, because there's elderly people next door, and they were fine, and there were people on the road at that point, and they were also worried about them. And I realised that they were worried about me because I'm now old. I love it. So it was quite interesting. So it was one of my first experiences of being regarded by young people as being old. So it was quite interesting in a way. And it took a while to realise that that what had happened. And I went back inside and started... Well, I mean, the main thing was to get the books out of the way, and so it was just a matter of stacking them on the floor, really, where they'd fallen, and just to create places to walk and, you know, and clean up. And then I was aware of all the glass and crockery and stuff that had broken, and so that meant then that I had to start cleaning up, and because it was too dangerous, and... And still get bits of glass and stuff in my foot if you walk around barefoot, just occasionally.
What about communications? Like, could you access like radio, phone, TV, telephone?
Telephone, landline was out. Oh, you just couldn't get through. I mean, it was engaged or, you know, whatever. Overloaded, probably. I could send texts occasionally. But even that was overloaded, and occasionally one would get through, and that was great because you knew that, you know, at least, because you didn't know what had happened around, so you know it was like when I drove out of our street. I mean, because at that point, I decided I'd go toward the airport. To actually check up on my partner's mother, and because he was over in Linwood, in his house, and he wouldn't have been able to get there, so I started going out, and I only got two blocks, and the traffic was in chaos, the road was a complete mess, and with liquefaction, and that was coming up, and the road was all sort of. Uneven, and there were people directing traffic away from that area, and it was like, oh, chaos. And I thought, nah, this is ridiculous, I'll just go back. And so I was aware that it was far worse around than our street, and then news started coming in that people had been killed and stuff like that. So I think I'd turned on the TV or something. I think that had come back on or something. So yes, so it was a bit of a shock, really.
And what about making contact with the other members of the support group?
Well, that was more difficult. Some of those people in the second one lost their house, and I had no idea where they went. So, you know, that there were two people in that situation. Others... one had to move out of her house, and I had no way of contacting her because I only had her computer, email, or landline. So that was gone. A few people, I was able to get through to a few people by email and by text, and they were fine. So yeah, and some. Took advantage of the New Zealand thing and went out of the city. So one person in particular who needed dressing for things on his legs, so he got on a plane and went to Auckland and was able to access that. But the majority of people survived very well. They had to. So, yes. Many of the people... in the group used to go to doctors in the High Street Medical Centre, and that whole area of course was destroyed, and for about 3 weeks we had no idea where those doctors were, and it was quite difficult to get information about where they were going to be, or where, you know, where that setup was going to be. Eventually, we were able to find out the hospital, the medications that seemed to be okay for most people, because most of the pharmacies were intact, so they didn't have too much of a problem. People accessing the hospital, well, if they didn't have a car, then it was a lot, well, in one sense it was a lot harder, but in other senses it was a lot easier, because one of the hubs for the buses was right outside the hospital, and there was a free bus that would go between the hubs, so it was actually a lot easier at that point. And why they've changed it back to where they, what they were doing, I have no idea, but the way that the emergency scene that they'd set up was great. It was a perfect sort of scene, really. Not only to access the hospital, but just to access the city. It just made complete sense. Driving was a pain, because you had to go around, and everyone had to go around. And so it was just this constant gridlock going around and around the city. And if you had major aftershocks, then, you know, people then, you know, those roads just, I mean, it was a nightmare. You'd take 2 or 3 hours to get home, and whereas it would only take 10 minutes ordinarily. But from what I hear, most people survived all of that quite well. They accessed family and friends. I haven't heard of anyone that had a major experience, you know, a negative experience around it.
You mentioned the high street doctors.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, if they couldn't get into those practices, did that mean that the patient records had gone as well?
Or I have no idea. I don't know how they... Well, mine are still there, so I don't know how they access them.
You can still access your records.
Yeah. So they've set up elsewhere, you see. And he seems to have all the records, so... Mm.
How soon after that February earthquake did the group meet up again?
I don't even know what day the February earthquake was.
22nd.
So it was. So that would have been a few days after the group met. So we wouldn't have met up again until the March, which was a good thing, really, because I wouldn't have been able to get food and things. Yeah.
When you met, what was the mood like?
It's difficult because the one person that we knew that had, or one of the people that we knew who had lost his house and everything in it, so the whole thing had collapsed. It was an old house that he had renovated over a number of years, and all his goods were in it, so computer and everything was gone. So... So those, I mean, and then you started hearing the stories of the others, of what had been happening with the others as well. So everyone had a story about something that had happened. And it was important just to, you know, allow that discussion to happen, really. And so for the next 2 or 3 months, really, that was the focus of the meetings, was just talking about what was happening. And it still comes up occasionally, but not so much now. Seems to have settled down, along with the earth.
As the months move on, does the psychology of living in a city where things have been broken or people have died, does that have an impact through? Do you find there's a higher level of stress or other kind of emotions that are coming through?
I'm not sure about whether it's the psychology of being in a city where people have died. I think it's being in a city that's now unstable, whereas we thought it was stable. So it's that unknown thing. So, like, I noticed that this building creaks a lot. So, and when people walk next door, it seems to sort of shake a little bit. And those sort of things are interesting to me. I find that I react to those. When I was in Wellington, I was horrified walking around your city. Absolutely horrified. I was thinking, far out. Anyone that would walk around this place needs their head read. Here, the thing I've noticed for myself is mainly driving. So you have to know where you're going. The roads are appalling in places. There are always new roadworks, and so sometimes you've got detours and all sorts of things that just appear out of, you know, one day and gone the next. But you also have people that, I keep joking that the new speed limit in Christchurch is 10 kilometres less than what it should be. So people seem to go 10, whenever there's a road cone, they seem to reduce the speed down 10 kilometres whenever there's an orange cone in the road, wherever, whether there's a sign or not. And occasionally you'll get elderly people who are driving, and of course for them their city has changed completely, and you know their landmarks have gone, and so they have no idea where they're going, and so their driving is sort of spontaneous. So they come to a corner and they need to turn left because they've just realised that if they don't turn left here, they'll never get, you know, to where they want to go, and so they're sort of, it's like, well. Or they're going along at 30 kilometres an hour trying to find where they're meant to go and stuff like that. When you're rushing or needing to get somewhere or know the road very well, then it gets really, you know, it gets tiresome to have to put up with that. And it's the only, the elderly I can appreciate, and usually once I find out that that's, it sort of dissipates. But it's the people who aren't old, who are just ditherers and or rubberneckers. And that part of it, I just find myself getting quite irritated. And people do some really strange things when they get irritated. And I've seen myself doing it as well. And passing in really strange places and, you know, tooting horns and things like that. So I've noticed that. So there's a lot more irritability. And the other thing is people that haven't been through the earthquakes who live here coming back. And I've had the experience now, I've been in every earthquake that's happened here. And after every one of them, I've had people arrive back who haven't been in them. And then there's this incessant talking about this and that and all the rest. And when there's an earthquake, it's an aftershock. It's like, you know, it's like this whole thing, you know, and then there's this, they launch off into this further dialogue of, you know, this, that, and all the rest, and about that aftershock, and it's like, oh, it's just an aftershock, come on, you know. and it gets, I appreciate it, but it gets quite tiresome, you know. Especially when it's the same people who keep coming back, and they seem to have come back after every earthquake and have never been in any of them. And I mean, their houses are write-offs and things like that, but it's just like, oh, please. It just gets, I mean, I find myself getting tired of that, really. And I don't know, there's only so much you can say about it, yeah. After having said all that.
What about within the peer support group? Has the dynamic changed? We're now, what, a year and a bit after the second big earthquake?
The dynamic has changed. Is that, what started happening was that people started doing the dishes, cleaning up after them. There seemed to be a lot more sort of concern for what people were going through, willingness to listen to what was going on, as well as irritability. And so there is that as well. But overall, there seems to be a sort of a more concern, I think, for each other. Mm. I don't know, I can't put my finger on it, but there seems to be a difference. And I don't know what it is, but there is a difference. I think, because most of them lived through all of these earthquakes, so, you know, and there does seem to be something in people that have lived through them. There seems to be an unspoken bond or something that occurs there. And you don't actually have to say very much. And it's just, you just get on and live life, really, and interact with each other. But it's on a different level. It's on a different scenario. I don't quite understand that, but no. Yeah. I think it must be something like being in a peer support group for people with HIV. Yeah, because you've got a commonality, so a common shared experience, and I don't quite understand. So, yes. One of the things that, I mean, I don't use the venues, the gay venues in Christchurch, but certainly friends of mine do, and certainly people in the group do, and. So there was this period of not having any sort of venues, really, where they could meet. And so it really brings up sort of questions around sex on-site venues and things like that. And so what do you do at that point in time? You know, so it was sort of like going back 30 years. Because the bars had gone and all the venues had gone, so some of the beats went there because they had closed as well. So all the public toilets had been closed for months, and so the only one that actually still operated was the beaches. So fortunately, probably for many people, it was summertime, but. I think online dating probably accounted for more contact, but I don't know. I don't know where people went or how they fulfilled that need. But certainly there have been two now set up, and three. So Cruise Bar was set up again, and then after a further aftershock was closed because of the building next door, but it's now reopened. The sauna and the two, the box, I think it was called, the Sex on Site venue, they both closed because their buildings were in the inner city. And I now see that, or I've heard that the box and, well, no, there was a new place that opened called The Closet and set up by someone from Auckland. And that the reports that I read of that were less than favourable in a way, because it seemed like it was set up on a shoestring, and that they were wanting people to go there, and then with the money that they got, they would do further renovations. So it seemed like it was a constant thing of a building site in some ways, which may have had its own appeal. But it's an interesting thing, really, that these people that used to use these things had to find other ways of meeting people.